Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and my guest today, Bernardo Kastrup, is in the Netherlands. Yes, it's midnight where he is, and because of technology, we are able to reach him across thousands of miles. And we're going to be talking about abilities of the mind and experiences that Bernardo Kastrup has had. And I think that you will find his information quite interesting, not only because of the personal aspect that he is sharing in this wonderful book of his called Dreamed Up Reality. We're going to be diving into the mind and maybe uncovering some of the secrets of nature. Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Do you mind if I call you Bernardo?
Not at all. You should.
Oh, good. Thank you so much. Now, I want people to know a little bit about you. You are a computer, you've got a PhD in computer engineering, and you've been involved in a number of various scientific research laboratories, and you've been involved with the Philips Research Laboratories, where the quantum field theory, you say, was discovered. And you've also been associated with the Organization for Nuclear Research. What is it that made you decide that you wanted to go to the, if you will, the right brain part of yourself and do some exploring regarding the capacities of the mind? So many times when people are involved in what is described as the linear thinking of science, they are not in any way, shape, or form remotely interested in going into the unknown relative to mind exploration. Why is it this became important to you?
Yeah, just a quick rectification, Donna. It was the Casimir effect of quantum field theory that was discovered at Philips Research. The theory itself has much broader origins. Coming back to your question, it was a surprise to me, actually. I never thought about pursuing right-brain-oriented activities for most of my early life. I have been, from very early on, indoctrinated into the scientific way of relating to reality, if you will. I've been a professional scientist for many years. At some point, you know, there comes a period in life, maybe in the mid-30s or so, where you start reevaluating things. I don't know exactly why or where it comes from. It comes from the unconscious, maybe. And you take a fresh look at things. And in my case, what helped was that being familiar with science and the scientific way of thinking and methods, I was also familiar with its limitations, with which a lot of people in general are not, and they have a romanticized view of science. I don't know that for sure, I'm just guessing. And and I didn't have that. Having been in the inside, I didn't have that romanticized view. I was keenly aware of the limits of where that kind of thinking could take me. And together with this impulse, I don't know, that you get at some point in life, I was curious about pursuing other avenues, and that's ultimately what I did.
As a scientist, usually, you know, there are theories of all kinds, and that's part of, I think, the exploration of science, is what if, the question, I wonder, is it possible? Those particular aspects of thinking stimulate curiosity, investigation, and many times it lays the groundwork for a level of accomplishment. When you decided that you were going to start exploring the aspects of the mind, What was the methodology that you decided you were going to adapt? Did you sign up for a class somewhere? Did you read 20 books? What was it that made you decide how you were going to do this?
Personal research. I did read a lot. I didn't sign up for any class. No, I was agnostic in terms of methods. I tried everything that I thought was reasonable enough and self-consistent, and then I tried to see what effect it had for me and whether it worked or not, in a very empirical approach, if you will. The original motivation came from a scientific approach, if you will. I mean, what we believe in science today is that the reality we ordinarily experience is a brain-produced hallucination, much like a dream. But because people have consistent experiences, like if I'm sitting in a room and there is somebody sitting next to me, that somebody will report witnessing the same room that I witness. So we assume that there is an external reality that calibrates our brain-produced hallucination of reality in such a way that such a modulation, such a calibration that comes from the outside impacts my hallucination in the same way that it impacts the hallucination of somebody else. So we seem to share a reality. But that's a postulate, because all we can really know is mind itself, are the impressions in mind. Could there be another way to explain this consistency of experiences? Could reality be a shared dream? That's what I wanted to explore, that possibility.
Carl Jung and others, in the early days of exploring the mind in a different application, often felt that there was a surreal fine line between what we perceive as our reality in this moment and what we can also shift into. And your example of being in a dream is very consistent with the way it was often described. When the word real is used, if you talk with someone who is in a mental institution, whatever they are experiencing in that moment may or may not be real. In our perception as we see it, they may see something entirely different. People that are on hallucinogenic drugs see things entirely different. There's so many different perspectives. When you started your exploration, and this is something you go into tremendous detail in your book, what did you start with? Did you start with meditation? Did you decide you were going to follow a particular set of protocols? And if so, what were they? And how were you able to be so, maybe it's your scientific background, because you really try to use words most effectively to describe your experiences, and lots of times that was difficult.
It is very difficult, because these highly subjective experiences, they don't render themselves very well to objective description with normal language. We don't have a set of shared experiences, a common dictionary, if you will, that we could use to describe them quickly. I think the main thing that came up to me was an awareness of how much, and that's what you alluded to in your question, how much the reality we experience is in fact a mirror of ourselves, is largely and maybe completely a reflection of our own mental processes. That's to me, it sort of dissolved the illusion that we truly live in a very objective reality. Becoming aware of how much the reality you perceive depends on your own mental processes is quite shocking, quite remarkable, and that's an impression I try to share and convey in the book.
There have been so many stories throughout history that, and today, where people find it, just as you did, very frustrating to describe their supernatural experiences, if you want to use that terminology, experiences of feeling, experiences of a sensory level, and to put it into words, sometimes people have tried to paint it because they feel that through the expression of art, the adage, a picture is worth a thousand words, is even more expressive. And with you, you've really tried to put into words the feelings that you have, and you came up with an imaginary universe. It's right in the beginning of your book. It's called Diverse. Talk to us about this and why you came up with this particular tale. That's what you say. It's a little tale about an imaginary universe. Tell us about this.
And what I attempted to do is that I knew what was coming in the book would defy the ordinary paradigm, the ordinary worldview that most people hold about what's going on. In other words, there being an objective world out there that modulates our hallucination of reality, so we all experience the same thing. I knew I would, what I was about to say would fly in the face of that. And what I wanted to do was to prime people with a little tale that was not too confrontational. It was a tale, after all, not a theory, but which would implant an intuition about how it could be, how reasonable it could be that a seemingly autonomous, continuous, very stable reality could emerge from a shared dream. In other words, how it could be that our hallucinations of reality could come to be highly synchronized, highly shared, despite there not being anything outside of the hallucination to modulate those hallucinations, which is the most skeptical, parsimonious hypothesis, of course. One we are not used to, but it is the most skeptical one. So with that tale, I try to show that synchronization constraints, if you will, could emerge naturally within the context of a shared dream that ultimately would get every subject in the dream to dream up the same thing consistently across dreamers. I try to show that with this little tale without using any technical words, just by telling a little story. And I hoped this intuition would become clear up front so people would read the rest of the book with a little more open mind and give me a little latitude to explore some unorthodox ideas, if you will.
You say learning new things about reality must entail downloading knowledge into our brains that was not there before. How can we download new knowledge into our brains by looking inside our own minds? I thought that question was quite a profound question. How can we download new knowledge into our brains by looking inside our own minds? There have been master teachers that have said for centuries that we have everything within ourselves. We are of the universe. The universe is us. Mm-hmm. What did you discover?
Well, I actually started from a hypothesis here, because I confess to suffer from the disease of extreme rationalism. So I needed...
You call it a disease, huh?
These days I do.
Oh my.
So even to try these things, I needed, for my own sake, to start with a model that would grant these things some coherency, some chance of being logically and rationally valid. So the model I started with, and which I truly believe in today, and all my experiences have been consistent with what I'm about to explain, is the following. We think today, most people in our culture, namely scientists, that the role of the brain is to generate conscious experience, to generate mind, that mind is a kind of iridescence around the interplay of subatomic particles in the brain, an iridescence around matter, if you will. That is one assumption about the role of the brain. It has not been proven. Correlations have been found between brain states and mind states, but correlations are not causations. To give you an example, if you see a large fire, you see lots of firemen. If you see a small fire, you see few firemen. That does not mean that firemen caused the fire, right? There is a correlation, but not a causation. Mm-hmm. The same thing may apply with the brain and the mind. The alternative hypothesis here, which is the one I started with, is that the role of the brain is to localize consciousness in space-time, to frame and modulate conscious experience in a particular location of space-time and filter out everything else. That hypothesis is entirely consistent with the correlations between brain states and mind states, because if the brain modulates and localizes experience, if you go and interfere with the localization mechanism, if you go and interfere with the filter, if you will, you will change conscious experience. So if you get drunk, your conscious experience will change. If you get hit in the head, your conscious experience will change. If a doctor stimulates areas of your brain with an electromagnetic field, your conscious experiences will change because you're messing up with the localization mechanism which frames your conscious experience. Now, at the same time, it is broader because now if you take out parts of this filtering mechanism, this localization mechanism in a safe way, the conclusion is what you derive from this model is that consciousness should declench, expand, delocalize, become less filtered. And there should be an influx of conscious states of information, if you will, that is not local to your specific position in space-time. An influx that could come across space, across time, and maybe from beyond space-time. That is the natural consequence of this hypothesis that the brain is actually a localizer, a filter, as opposed to the generator of consciousness. And by deploying certain techniques to reduce brain activity, which even psychedelics do. I didn't know that at the time I wrote the book. This is very recent research from this year that has been published in the Proceedings of the American Academy of Science. Even psychedelics reduce brain activity. They don't increase brain activity anywhere. So by reducing brain activity, you allow consciousness to declench, to delocalize. And if you succeed in remembering those conscious states afterwards, after the filter comes online again, then you have brought in information that is transcendent. And that is the goal of this whole enterprise, after all.
What you just described is what I was teaching in a class in intuitive development, that we are just the processing facilitator. And one of the comments that you make in your book is how whatever filters we have in our own minds, due to experience, indoctrination, whatever it may be, that often colors what may come through in the conscious process, because we have to be able to somehow or another express ourselves, relate to something in some way, some format. That's why stories are so important. And when you were going through your very first experiment, you really wanted to embark on a journey, in your own words, where you said you wanted to confirm through direct experience your own metaphysical position that consciousness in its most fundamental and unfiltered state is boundless, yet at the same time unified. And you were to learn a very, very powerful, as well as a painful lesson about this. What was the lesson you learned?
Well, there have been so many. It's hard to even know where to begin. To me, at
least.
Well,
let's begin right with your very first phase, because you go through four phases in your book. I mean, I'm sure there were even more to it. But you, for the sake of writing, went and put it into four different experiments.
Yeah.
So in your first experiment, what was it that for you was painful and yet at the same time absolutely marvelous?
The marvelous part of the experience was what I now explain to myself as this delocalization mechanism, this declenching of consciousness, this expansion across space-time and beyond. Which put me in contact with what I then realized was my true identity, my true integral identity, put me in contact with aspects of myself that I had forgotten since early childhood, since maybe even before conception. I don't know how to explain that. This feeling of wholeness, of being back home for the first time after an eternity in exile, being to the true source of what I am as a conscious point of view, as a conscious entity, if you will, realizing that reality as we see it is very transitory. It is a very small part of our existence as conscious beings. That was the exhilarating, highly comforting part of that first experiment. what was very painful was returning to egoic awareness, returning to the ego, because before the ego really is in place and you can file all of your worldly problems in their drawers where, you know, they are kept in check, you go through a phase where you're very vulnerable. It may be only a few seconds when you're coming back from that meditative state, but those few seconds feel like an eternity, and it's like waking up from a very pleasant dream in the morning and remembering all of your life's problems. During those few seconds, you don't have your defenses up, and your problems jump on you when you are in a very vulnerable state, and that is excruciatingly painful.
In your second experiment, you discovered your inner theater, as you described it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I wanted to ask, did you do a meditation when you did this? Were you listening to music? What was your setting for going into this altered state of mind? How did you set yourself up for it?
Meditation, in my mind, is the quintessential technique. Whatever else you do, you ought to meditate. Otherwise, you're embarking on a journey that you did not plan, that you have no control of. I mean, you never really have control of, but at least you can try to steer it and maintain yourself disciplined in a way. So I do think meditation is quite quintessential. I took it all very seriously. I brought in some of my scientific mentality to it. You know, when you do an experiment, you prepare for it, you set goals, you evaluate your methodology, you review your methodology, you try to have everything cleared out in advance, and then you press the button and you go in after having made good preparation. I think the setting is essential. You have to be in the right state of mind. The technique that you apply is essential. You have to find out what works for you. In my case, I combine different things. I have a nice mind machine, meditative techniques. I've tried different things at different times. But I have always had an attitude of discipline and certainly respect and caution with regards to these things.
You have in your book a statement where you say, each segment of the inner experience seemed to be a kind of lesson, complementing the previous one and setting the stage for the next one. When you were going through this, and you were going into these various levels that of mind exploration, going where you had never gone before, did you find that the aspect of curiosity became really strong? Were you wanting to know more? Or was there a sense of, gee whiz, I think I'll just leave this alone. I'm happy where I am right now. I don't think I want to go any further. Did it spark an energy of enthusiasm for more exploration?
Absolutely. But this is not new to me. I think this has driven my whole life. I am never satisfied in terms of, okay, I will stop here. I've seen enough, been there, done it. I'm satisfied. No, I'm never. I've never had that state. I think it would be blissful. I envy people who can have that state. I don't. The more I find out, the more I need to find out, the more eager I become to find out more. So preceding every experiment, if you will, I had a very heightened state of curiosity from the second one onwards, because I have many failed attempts before I was successful for the first time. I was about to give this up several times. But after I succeeded for the first time and I had an unambiguous experience and I knew that I could and therefore would succeed again, curiosity preceded every experiment. I was very excited, and I had to keep it under control every time. But during the experience itself, what is curious is that I registered a lot of it, maybe most of it, as a recollection, as the return of a very intimate, familiar, although appalling, extremely weird memory, but something that had always been part of me, something that was not new. It was just, oh, of course, this is what's going on. This is what has been happening for eternity. This is who I am. Sure, no problem there. And only when you return to a normal state of egoic awareness, only then do you realize how outside of the boundaries of our current worldview that whole thing was.
How has this changed your life?
Externally, from the point of view of the outside world, I think it changed a little. Maybe I've become more tolerant, more understanding. I was not a very, how to say, I had a lot of Richard Dawkins in me before. <you know? laughs>
Okay.
So that part of me softened up and mellowed up quite a bit more. I still think there is a lot of nonsense out there that my mind didn't change about it, but I am a lot more cautious before passing judgment on things because I realized that there's a lot of things others know that I didn't know, and therefore there can still be a lot of things people know that I still don't know to this day. Internally, of course, it has changed me a lot. I have a very different way of looking upon the world and looking upon reality today. I'm a much richer perspective, a much less closed-minded and dogmatic, scientifically dogmatic perspective on reality. And I find it quite fulfilling. Many questions open up. I don't feel I am really anywhere close to finding the answer. I don't know whether there is an answer. I don't know whether this is something that you can explain in a causally closed way. Maybe that's not what's going on, but I feel I've made steps forward.
With that, I would like to say you have a quote right at the very end of your book by Jacques Vallée. You say, "Passport to Magonia. We cannot be sure that we study something real because we do not know what reality is. We can only be sure that our study will help us understand more, far more, about ourselves." And you say you cannot think of a greater adventure. And obviously, your adventure of exploring your mind and putting it into a book, Dreamed Up Reality, I think takes a lot of courage, because as a scientist, there would be many of your colleagues that would say, what have you been smoking? And you just can put it in. You've really done a phenomenal job at trying to explain it to the best of your capacity, but it is an individual experience. What is your website, Bernardo, that people can go to find out more about the work that you've been doing?
It is www.bernardocastrup.com, Castrup with a K. And I also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/BernardoCastrup.
Well, Dr. Bernardo Castrup, your book is a fascinating read, and I'm so glad you kept the diary and decided to put your personal experiences into the book, because I think your being of the scientific community and having the background that you have, and to be able to say that you've opened up your own Pandora's box of curiosity about really the unknown and so much perspective, I think it's a fascinating read. It's one that makes people realize anyone can be an adventurer and explorer of themselves if they want to be.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you for being a guest on my show and for staying up so late in the Netherlands. Rest well, and I look forward to your next publication when it comes out.
Me too. Thank you very much. Take care.
You're very welcome. Dr. Bernardo Castrup, that's B-E-R-N-A-R-D-O, K like King, A-S-T like Tom, R-U-P like Paul. com. Go to his website. You'll find out more. He has information on his Facebook page and other things there. The book is Dreamed Up Reality, Diving Into Mind to Uncover the Astonishing Hidden Tale of Nature. Fascinating book. This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number, if you'd like to call in and chat with me directly, is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I hope you enjoyed my guest today. I find it absolutely marvelous when we can have someone from the scientific community that says, I want to explore the unknown. And this is something that when you can have someone share their experience of what they discovered, even just a smidgen of it, because it is very hard to express to someone what it is that you go through. And for every one of us, as he mentioned in the book, we look at things through our own filters. And so that is something we need to keep in mind. And I know when I'm teaching classes, it's one of the things I always like people to understand. How you perceive things, how you sense things, how you have information flow through you in the intuitive capacity can happen in a myriad of ways. I'll give you an example. In my last class, we in Quantum Mind 3, one of my students, we were doing what is called a billet experiment. And that is where you hold something. You have no idea what is in the envelope. You have no way of identifying it. And you give information about what is on, let's say, maybe a card. I passed out little cards, little index cards, to have someone write something down on it and then put it in the envelope. And this one lady in the class, she just happened to look up at an image, a painting, that was on the wall. And for some reason, it was like click, click, click in her head, and then she wrote down information. And what she had seen up on the wall was a picture of flowers, but in front of that picture, there was a birdcage of type in which there were flowers in that cage. Well, she wrote down a bird in a cage, and she didn't understand it, because one of the things that I'll tell students is you don't judge anything. You write down, because you want your conscious mind to remember what it is that's coming through you, you write down exactly what you get. You don't add anything to it or take anything away from it. And so she wrote down bird in a cage. Well, this particular envelope belonged to an individual that had asked a question about a particular relationship in their life. And they were at a loss to know what to do with that relationship. We didn't know what the question was until the envelope was opened. And to this lady's surprise, she said, I get bird in a cage. Now, she couldn't relate to it, and I said, my goodness, it's a perfect explanation. This individual is feeling like she's trapped, just like a bird in a cage. She doesn't know what to do with her situation, how to solve the problem. And this happened over and over and over in the class. But this one lady's experience was a visual one. And in her case, she picked up on an imagery that intuitively linked the language of description that was needed to respond to the unknown question that was inside the envelope. Fascinating stuff. So we're all senders and receivers, and I just think it's marvelous when you begin the journey, and this is something my mentor told me many, many years ago. She said, Donna, you need to know something. Once you start on this path, you will never, ever leave it. She said, you're always on the path, because once the journey has begun, you can never go back to what you have previously been aware of. You can't. There's just no way you can. So, fascinating stuff. I just thought I would share those few thoughts with you. Now, for those of you in New York City and the state of Alaska, I'm going to be in New York on Friday and Saturday, and if you'd like to meet with me while I'm there, give me a call at my office, 253-582-5604. I'm going to be interviewing about 100 authors for prospective opportunities to be guests on the show, as well as meeting with clients. So if you wanted to contact me, 253-582-5604. And then in Alaska, I'm going to be up there May 2nd through the 7th. I'll be in Fairbanks first and then in Anchorage. If you'd like to meet with me while I'm up there, 253-582-5604. And, of course, as always, the Donna Sebo Show is going to be done no matter where I am, and that is what I'm so grateful for. I think that it is just marvelous what we're able to do with technology, and it's amazing. There's more and more stuff that keeps coming around, and sometimes I wonder, am I ever going to catch up? I don't think so. Quick like a bunny, I just thought I'd share some fun things with you, just some odds and ends of information about things that were considered scandalous. And when you look back in history about certain things that have been done, and you go, what was the big deal? Well, we have to remember, every generation had its protocols of one kind or another. Well, why don't we chat about something as simple as a wedding dress? Now, in today's world, and the big month for weddings is coming up, that's the month of June, that's when so many weddings are scheduled, and it is always the magnificent white gown, typically, that these beautiful, beautiful young women come out with, and it's just such a joy to see them, and they're just so elaborately gorgeous many times. Well, do you know, in 1558, it was scandalous? Yes, Mary, Queen of Scots, she had an all-white wedding dress, and it was considered scandalous because, at that time, white was the color of mourning. That's right. It was not black as we typically know it today. It was white. And in the Japanese culture, white is also the color of mourning. So it's fascinating how things shift and change, because I don't believe that's the case among the Scots at this time. And then, you know what? There was a novel called Fanny Hill. Have you ever heard about it? I don't think I've ever read it, but I've heard about it, and oh my goodness, in the 1700s, it was considered absolutely scandalous, totally racy. They had orgies in it. They talked about homosexuality in the book, and I guess in today's world, it'd be considered pretty tame. But it was really hot stuff, and John Cleland was the author at that time. And you know what? There were two ladies that created a horrific scandal, and this was in the 1700s in Irish high society. What did these two ladies do that was so infamous for the times? They ran away together. Mm-hmm. They had not wanted to be forced to get married to men that they didn't love. So they just said, we're not participating in this. And they ran away to Wales. And they lived together for 50 years. And then both of them passed away, apparently, in a very close time frame to each other. So we look back at histories, and my goodness, It's just amazing how things have changed. And now we don't think of stuff as being a big deal, but we still do have a few little items, I'll reverse the words. By golly. That's just the way it is. Life moves on in an interesting way. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. Telephone number to call in to is 888-627-6008. We have got tomorrow, Lou Paradise. We're going to be talking about pharmaceuticals tomorrow. We're going to be talking about laws, regulations, and things like this. Lou Paradise is going to be my guest. Then on Thursday, we are going to be playing a Best of Donna repeat of the show last week because I'm going to be in a plane flying to New York City. But on Friday, we are going to be talking with Gregory Crouch. He has one of the best books that I have read on history and aviation in a long time. It's called China's Wings, and it's about how America, just at the blooming of aviation history, had an alliance with China so that they could come into the modern world of aviation. It's a fascinating picture of a country that we look at today, and they're just expanding with technology and all kinds of things that they've not had an opportunity to expand into. And by golly, they're going like crazy. But there's a history behind the association between the United States and China that I think you'll find intriguing. So Gregory Crouch is going to be my guest. And then upcoming also, we are going to be talking with Anne Gerkrich, Saved by Cancer, Katrina, and Dogs. This woman's story about what she did and the interaction with the rescuing of dogs during Hurricane Katrina really will touch your heart. So we've got so many wonderful guests coming up, and I do hope you tell your friends. Oh, and don't forget, the Donna Sebo Show, as of May 1st, is going to be shifting to 9 a.m. Pacific time. That's right, 9 a.m. will be live, 9 to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday, right here on bbsradio.com. So be sure you note that information. Well, I know we're very close to having a break here, and what I wanted to do was to just share a little bit of a thought. And that is, in our world of technology today, someone decided to make a comment, and it was a comedian by the name of Nick. He said, one day, millions of light years away, an alien may hear the first FM signal all the way from Earth, unless the alien is driving under a bridge. Boy, do we know what that feeling's like. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to take a break for just a moment, and when we come back, those phone lines are open, and you're welcome to give me a buzz. All I need, remember, is your first name or initial, and then I'll give you information about yourself and what is going on in your life. So call me at 888-627-6008. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007, that's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. Resourcefulness. That's one of the things that a human being has a capacity for that I think is just phenomenal if we're willing to implement it. And our oceans, well, we've got a lot of challenges with the oceans. However, there are people that are saying, let's take something that might be an absolute eyesore and let's create something of beauty. Well, people are doing that, well, that very thing today, and maybe you've heard about it. They're taking tanks or subway cars even, old ships, and they're converting them into places where coral can grow. And this is some information that I have been aware of in the past. I've seen various programs on this. And I think what has happened is that there is an awareness that instead of creating havoc and mayhem and destruction for the underwater world, we can take things that otherwise might be, let's say, bad or negative, and convert it into something positive. There's a marine sanctuary in the Gulf of Mexico, and they've got steel pillars that they have put into place. And it is covered. These steel pillars are covered with all kinds of sponges, and they're absolutely beautiful. They're these rich, rich color tones. And, of course, the sponges are part of the environment, undersea environment. And they say it protects small fish. And what's happening, too, is that it's created some kind of a buffer against some of the wild waves that they have just off the coast of Texas. And then the ship of the U.S. Coast Guard called the Cutter Duane, they intentionally took the interior corridors of that ship, set it up in such a way that it was going to serve as a home for all kinds of sea life. And the photo that's in front of me is just absolutely mesmerizing. You would absolutely be totally, completely unaware that this was part of a U.S. Coast Guard ship. Now, they intentionally sank it underwater in 1987. It created an artificial reef 120 feet below the surface. And this reef is just gorgeous. It is absolutely fabulous. And the sea life that it's absorbing and contributing homes to is amazing. The panorama of color in this underworld is just absolutely awesome. Now, shopping carts, would you think they'd be something you'd want to put down in the ocean? That doesn't sound exciting to me. But there is a national artificial reef plan that is in place. And they are responsible for the regulation of the submersion of very, very large items. And they want to make sure before anything goes down into the water area where they're planning on building coral reefs, that before it goes down, that they are really, really clean. And I thought, interesting bit of information. Now, what happened to bring this about is that there was a period where a lot of tires were dropped down into water areas, and they ended up breaking apart and coming ashore. Now, this occurred in the 70s. So they said, nope, we've got to use materials where it's not going to harm the environment, where critters aren't going to be feeding off of it in the way that it could bring harm, and we don't want stuff washing up on the shores. So we have here a 50-ton M60 Army tank. They have sunk 100 of these. They did this in 1994. They wanted an underwater fleet of artificial reefs off of the coast of Alabama. Isn't that amazing? 50 ton per tank. 100 of them. That is a lot of material. But can you imagine how that is something that is so heavy it's going to hold its positioning, if you will. But the sea life is growing up and around it. Also, have you heard of the Neptune Memorial Reef? Well, this is an underwater cemetery, and I've heard about this, and I've seen a lot of programs on it, and it is really fascinating. People choose to be cremated, and right now they've got about 200 people that have opted to have this underwater cemetery, and it is just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. They put in columns and arches, and these are made of cement, and one day they said the coral and algae, all of this will be totally covered. It's amazing. Well, when you think about things that have been underwater for so long, there's all this sediment, all of this material that covers it. And this, it just takes time. But sea life, just like all life, does an adaptation sometimes. It's absolutely mesmerizing. But what is wonderful about this, think of all those tanks. They're not firing bullets. They're down there on the ocean floor, and they're going to be a haven. Something that was a negative is going to be put into a positive. I think it's just, again, a form of resourcefulness. I think it is something we just need to remember that, well, these things are possible. There are so many things we can do, so many things that we really can make a difference about, and it starts with one person, with an idea, working with a number of other people, and by golly, things happen. It's so important to remember that. Your mind belongs to you. You have got such wonderful talents and abilities. Who knows? You may come up with a way of promoting energy that nobody else had thought of. Which, by the way, in my upcoming newsletter in May, I have in the part of my newsletter where I have gold nuggets, true stories about real people, there is a gentleman by the name of Ray Bunker, and I have featured him in that segment of my newsletter, and there's a video. This man did something that started 45 years ago. He was way ahead of his time. I think you're going to find it a fascinating read. You're going to be amazed. I'm trying right now to actually have him as a guest on the show. This man is literally changing the lives of cultures, third world cultures around the world, and they have what they call the Barefoot College. Fascinating stuff. So that's going to be coming up on the show. I'm hoping to get him as a guest. He is in India, but we will see how we will be able to arrange something. I'm really looking forward to it. This is an awesome video. So on this newsletter that will be coming out on May the 1st, his story will be in there, and I hope that you will take the opportunity to read it. And by the way, for those of you that would like to subscribe to my newsletter, all you have to do is send me an email, donna@delphiinternational.com or donnasebo@comcast.net. Whichever way you want to go, just say, Donna, add me to your newsletter list, and I will do exactly that. And you also get to read them online. Well, I know we are just about out of time. I thought I could share with you a true story about a man by the name of Daniel Douglas Home. Now, this is a man that was known as an extraordinary psychic medium, and we're going to be sharing his story, but it won't be today. I would just say before I close out the show, I would like for you to be aware of one thing, and that is whoever you are, wherever you are unique. And you have been given the gift of life for the opportunity of expressing yourself in a very special way that is your way. Enjoy the journey of finding out what that is, because that's what life is, a journey of discovery about who we are and why we came in to this experience of life and what we're going to be able to give to it. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless you. Have a fabulous day or evening wherever you might be. And we'll be back here tomorrow, same time, same place, and we're going to be talking about the pharmaceutical industry. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.